Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, January 22nd. I'm Ray Graff. Time to scour your attic, your basement, your closet for hidden treasures, because today we will discuss antiques. And we have Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques in the studio to answer your questions. So whether you're a collector or you want to know the best way to refurbish an antique piece, now's the time to call 800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email your question to voxpop@wamc.org. Mark Lawson, your antique questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing antiques today with Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques. Mark Lawson has been buying, selling, and collecting interesting things since he was 8 years old. After running a traditional antique shop for several years and opening a gallery on Broadway in Saratoga, Mark was approached by Sotheby's in 2000 to assist organizing and curating single-owner sales on Sotheby's.com. Mark is a past member of the American Society of Appraisers and has completed courses in the NYU Appraisal Studies Program in Period American Furniture at the Metropolitan Museum. He is also certified in diamond grading from the Gemological Institute of America. Today, Mark travels throughout the region meeting with clients, helping them settle estates and family treasures. Our number to call if you have a question about antiques, maybe something lurking up in the attic, something safe, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Mark Lawson, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
You know, I don't think we've ever done a program on antiques before. How did you get into the business?
I've been fascinated with old and interesting things as long as I can remember. I was fascinated with jewels and jewelry stores. I grew up splitting my time between New York and Saratoga. I loved 57th and Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go by Tiffany's without stopping in to visit the Tiffany Diamond, which was an egg-sized yellow canary diamond that they had mounted in a case in the corner.
So even when you were a little kid, this had a certain mystique for you. And one of the things, and I must confess, I think a lot of youngsters, I know I did, we were interested. We saw old stuff up in the attic. You were over at Grandma's house, and you said, wow, this must be valuable. And one of the things I've learned in my life is, just because it's old doesn't mean it's valuable. What's the most common thing that people bring to you and say, hey, look at this, man? And you say, well, you know, I'm sorry. It's not worth that much.
Well, there's so much has changed over the last 10 to 15 years. Young people don't collect things the way our generation, our parents' generations did. It's a very different world, and that's really affected the marketplace a lot. There's still wonderful things that I see all the time, just very often many of them aren't worth quite as much as they used to be, although the market for really great stuff is still very, very, very strong. I do get one of the things that I used to sell tons of 20 years ago was Depression glass. American Depression glass. It came in boxes of soap, bought at the 5 and 10 in the 1930s and 40s. Used to be a hot collectible. I'd buy it by the truckload
if
I could.
But there was a lot of it. How could it be a real collectible if there was that much of it?
Well, it's an interesting thing. In order for something to be collectible and for there to be a market for it, there has to be enough of it out there, widely distributed enough for people to A, know about it, remember it from being in grandma's house or whatever, because people collect things that, you know, they have a sentimental attachment to. And then there has to be enough out there, if you're interested in it, that you can go out and find it.
You know, I remember as a kid, in the garage, there was a box, and I was very excited. There was Confederate money.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wow, look at this. And it turned out there was so much Confederate money printed, it really wasn't worth very much.
That's true. I mean, the original Confederate money that I see quite a bit can have some very good value today still. But we do see a lot of reproductions, and they still, I think, you can buy packets of reproduction Confederate currency at, you know, the battlefield at Gettysburg or in Colonial Williamsburg gift shop, that sort of thing. But and that can be very confusing. But it's if you describe it as somebody, it's easy to differentiate the reproduction stuff from the old stuff.
Well, there is many there's a list of many things I want to discuss here. And I know that one of the things that you wanted to bring up, and maybe we should talk about this for a couple of minutes before we start taking calls, is this fundraiser you're doing for the Albany Institute.
Yeah, we're sponsoring the first show that they've done showcasing the Albany Institute's collection of jewelry. It starts this weekend. It's called Bejeweled and Bedazzled. Mm-hmm. It runs for, I think, 4 or 5 months. And in March, we're going to do a big jewelry appraisal day. We're going to have a group of certified jewelry appraisers, and as a fundraiser for all donating their time as a fundraiser for the Institute, to have people come in with their jewelry and get it appraised.
This is something that you have been moving into, is appraisal of jewelry lately.
Yes, that's true. That's a segment of the market that's remained strong. It's always been a passion of mine. It's one of the areas that has remained relatively unscathed. I mean, fashions change,
right?
So, and you know, some things go out of style and come in style. But you know, the part of the thing is just the price of gold. I mean, the price of gold has risen so much in the last 15 years. It pulled back some, but you know, you have old jewelry that people have sitting around in their jewelry boxes can still be worth to the normal person that is unfamiliar with it. It blows their mind sometimes when they realize when I tell them, oh, you know, how much money they have sitting there in that little box.
Well, Mark Lawson is our guest today of Mark Lawson Antiques, and our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Let's take a call or two before our first break. We go to Martin in Cohoes. Martin, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a collection of letters, military letters from the 1880s. I guess you'd call it the Indian War era. And they're really beautiful hand-done letters back and forth. I guess it was a soldier's scrapbook. And I have a cover with his name on it and about 30 or 40 letters that are glued onto old pages of scrapbook paper. I was wondering how to sell this one at a time, or is there interest in it, like if I brought it to an auction or what? What do you think?
Well, it sounds like an amazing thing that you have. The value for this sort of thing, well, the 1880s is later in terms of general desirability. I mean, people really, the Holy Grail is kind of Revolutionary War memorabilia, Civil War memorabilia is very collectible, but it's all about the content. It's all about what is described in the letters, and the more exciting, the more interesting, the more specific descriptions of historical events, the value can be very, very, very good.
I looked up the names of the signatures on the letters, and like Summer Hayes, I know I found out that his wife followed him around from Western Fort to Western Fort and wrote a book called Vanishing Arizona, which was like a number one seller in the 1880s. And a lot of these names were generals in the Civil War and Medal of Honor winners and things like that I found when I looked them up in the computer. But as for content, it's kind of blasé. The content is like from people being recruited and people owing money for their, you know, being owed money for their salaries. And also there's a lot of them for people to go to court for, you know, for things they did wrong.
So with something like that, what's going to help the value is the autographs of the important people, of historical figures. Even if the content is, as you say, blasé, if it's signed by Civil War generals, signed by important and significant historical figures, that's still going to give them some good value.
And what would be the first step that Martin should take to find out more about what that is worth? I would imagine that is so specific an item that you really have to find somebody who's interested in collecting that to get a value.
I think the first thing is to go to a reliable specialist or local source to get a referral, to find out, you know, where the best place to go. For that sort of material, there's an auction house in the Midwest called Cowans, C-O-W-A-N-S. They're very good. They specialize in military memorabilia. James Julia Auctions used to do that stuff. They've been absorbed by Morphy Auctions. I'm sure they still have a division that deals in that sort of stuff. But those are two places that Martin could try.
Mark Lawson is our guest today. We talk antiques on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. What is the most common treasure that could be lurking in the average person's home?
The most common treasure? Yeah. Boy, that's hard to say.
Well, what could some of them be before we take our first break?
Well, I'll tell you, I had a guy come in. He was a long-term client. He was helping his wife clear out his father-in-law's house, who had been a hoarder. They were throwing a box of pamphlets into the dumpster that looked old. He said, wait a minute, let me, looks like good stuff, let me go take it to Mark, have him check it out. We looked at it. There was one pamphlet in there. I opened it up. I started reading. It said, "These are the times that try men's souls." And I said to myself, that sounds so familiar to me. And I looked it up. Anyway, it was pamphlet written by Thomas Paine.
Wow.
Right before Christmas, 1776, the Continental Army was getting whooped. Most of the guys, their term of service was up December 31st. They were going home. They're farmers, merchants.
Mm-hmm.
George Washington had this essay read on Christmas morning, 1776, and it's considered the turning point of the American Revolution.
Was this an original, or was this?
This was an original.
Wow.
We sold it for him for $100,000.
Yikes. All right, let's take a break here. Mark Lawson is our guest. It's Antiques Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number, and we'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Mark Lawson of Mark Lawson Antiques here today. And remember, this is a call-in show, so Mark can't see the item you're discussing, but he'll give you a ballpark, perhaps. You never know. This one came in via email, Mark, from Nancy. And Nancy writes, "My husband and I have been married for almost 30 years. Each of our families gave us a full set of silver, plus some serving pieces. Our son will have no interest in these. Should we hold on or consider selling? Is it worth anything?" And that's from Nancy.
Well, this is something that I get asked quite a bit. As we all know, lifestyles have changed. People don't entertain or keep house the same way. New houses don't have formal dining rooms. It's all changed.
Yeah.
And most people, they're working. If you have to polish it, you can't put it in the dishwasher. They don't want anything to do with it. So what do you do? If the silver is sterling silver, that is solid silver, it's going to have some intrinsic value for the silver. And most of the time you can tell, because they passed a law in 1891, any silver made for sale in the United States has to be 92.5% pure, the English sterling standard, and it has to be marked with the word sterling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the first thing you can do. You can look on the back, see whether it says sterling or not. If it doesn't say sterling, most of the time it's going to be silver plated,
mm-hmm,
and going to have very little value today. But if it's solid silver, you know, a regular normal size set is going to be worth at least $500 to $1,000 for its silver value and is readily saleable.
So,
there are a few patterns and makers that can be worth more than just the silver value, but as time goes by, there's less and less demand even for those.
All right, this one's from Barbara, and Barbara writes, "Wondering about an unusual Tiffany lamp. It's small, 12 inches high, with a mustard yellow glass, also a collection of iron animals." That's from Barbara.
Well, there's always toys are a popular collectible, still are, always have been. So the metal animals, depending on what they are, could have some value if they have some age, depending on their condition. Mm-hmm. The what's the other thing?
Tiffany lamp, about 12 inches high, mustard yellow glass.
So Tiffany, if it's a signed Tiffany lamp made by Tiffany Studios, it's going to have very good value. But a lot of times, people call any lamp that looks like or is in the style of a Tiffany lamp, they call it a Tiffany lamp. And most of the time when people show me lamps that they say is a Tiffany lamp, that's the category that it falls
into.
It's
a knockoff.
It's a knockoff or just, you know, something in the same style made later. It'll have some decorative value. And it can have good value depending on the age and depending on the quality. But it depends on, you know, several factors.
All right. Mark Lawson is our guest. Back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. TJ in Kerhonkson. TJ.
Hi, Mark. Thank you. Listen, I have it's not Gene Roddenberry's lamp, but I have the lamp in the same color that inspired Gene Roddenberry's design of the Star Trek Enterprise 1701.
Nice.
And it was featured in a Star Trek kind of combined episode where, now this is for real Star Trek fans, but Captain Sisko was a science fiction writer, and they actually show you my lamp in the same color Roddenberry had, which is like a burgundy. The thing is, it was designed, I believe, by an architect. And he did some of them that were straight up. And then this one, like, extends out and swivels. But I don't know. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Off the top of my hand, I don't. I'd have to see some pictures. You really have to go to, you know, in this case, Google's your friend. Go online, and that's one thing you can do is go online and just plug in Star Trek lamp, Gene Roddenberry inspired, and
yeah,
maybe that'll.
I found it kind of once, but what's interesting about it is also just for any Star Trek fan. It's interesting for people to know that it was a deco art desk lamp that inspired Gene Roddenberry's design of the Star Trek Enterprise.
I'll be darned.
And this was a lamp as I said, he did these straight up post,
right,
like erect ones, and then one that kind of leans out and swivels, and it belonged to an executive of Gibson Guitars.
Oh, there you go.
And the guy was going to throw it out. And I said, wait a minute, that looks like the Enterprise.
Well,
and then a couple of years later, there it is featured in a Star Trek episode. It must belong to Mrs. Roddenberry.
Well, okay. Something like that that was made by a good maker, that's high quality, that has, you know, some provenance and was designed by an important early 20th century Art Deco designer, particularly today, that type of decorative arts are very popular in the marketplace, and I think it potentially has some very good value.
You know, you've said something very interesting, and that's Google is your friend, and it's kind of a common phrase around here. But in your experience now, in what you do, has the proliferation of internet search capabilities made for a more informed customer or a more deluded customer?
Well, it's tough, you know, because we all know how much the information is there and how much of it is good and how much of it is bad, and how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad,
right,
in all of it. So, and it's no different in antiques. And in antiques, the problem is so many things have changed in value so much. You know, a lot of things have dropped in value. Some things have gone up in value, but more than half of the time, I got to say, the prices that you see online are more people putting things up, you know, with wishful thinking, maybe with what they hope it's worth, what it used to be worth. So it's really tricky. I subscribe to professional databases that track actual sales results. That's the only way I'm able to stay on top of the marketplace. And it's changing all the time. The prices last year are different from from what they are this year.
I mean, you'll travel around and you'll, you know, kind of like the Antiques Roadshow and give people some advice here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it kind of hurt you when you have to take the air out of their balloon?
It's tough. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I get sweet little older women coming in with their prized collection of Hummel figurines.
Yeah.
Or a family with
those
values
dropped on those.
Oh,
as well.
Oh my goodness, they've lost 90% plus of their value, you know, and that's tough. Those are the tough stories to tell, the tough info to give out.
All right, let's go back to the phones and we go over to Paul in Rome, New York, home of the Bocce Ball World Series. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
You're on.
Yeah, I found a hunk of purple quartz. I think they call it something like azimuth or something.
Amethyst.
Yeah.
Yep, a purple variety of quartz.
Yeah, it's got purple on the top, white in the middle, and on the bottom it seems to be connected to something that's black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're attractive. Nice mineral specimens.
It's something that was given out as a...
Well, these are pretty. Quartz is one of the most common minerals, and it comes in a variety of colors. Yellow is called citrine. Brown is called smoky quartz. So what you have is something that's relatively common. It's beautiful, but it's going to have a little bit of value, but not an awful lot. It's something that you'd say is more interesting than valuable.
Oh, okay.
But a nice thing.
The Herkimer Diamond Mines, I had something really cool.
Yeah, that was fun. Have you ever gone over there digging them?
No, never did.
It was a field trip 50 years ago when I was in elementary school.
Yeah. Great.
Well, Paul, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop today. Mark Lawson is our guest, and we talk antiques. We go over to Meg in Old Forge. How are things up in Old Forge, Meg?
Lots of snow and little wind. It's kind of different than at home, actually. It's nice.
That's good.
I love that area. We go up to the Waldheim every year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's getting crowded right now. It's 'tis the season, you know.
Sure.
It's, now that we got like 3 feet of snow on the ground.
Yeah.
Well, it's not that bad, but.
Yeah. So what's up?
All right. So my father always told me that, you know, Japan was a large manufacturer of fine porcelain and decorative ceramics. And after World War II, they changed and they refused to stamp anything with Japan on the bottom of anything that they manufactured. In fact, they created a town called USA, USA. And so off and on, I collect what I feel are old Japanese ceramics because they actually have Japan printed on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I have various things, little pitcher that, you know, little cow creamer, little froggy things. Is there any like validation? Like, is my father right? Or is this just another one of those like old dad tales? Like,
well, the Japanese started making really fine porcelain in the 19th century and carried that through into the 1920s and 30s up until World War II. There's in the early 20th century, they marked their ware Nippon for the English name for Japan.
And I majored in Japanese, so I can read it and speak it. So Nippon or Nihon.
Yep. So some of the early 20th century hand-painted Nippon porcelain is collectible and have some good value. After World War II, we beat the Japanese. We occupied Japan as part of revitalizing their economy. We started getting them to manufacture stuff. And typically, they were inexpensive, cheap things made for export. I know from... From what I know, the story is when they were occupied, the things that they manufactured under our supervision were often stamped with occupied Japan, and they would try to erase or have them not go out with the occupied mark because it was a source of shame for them. So that's what I know of the story. Typically, the Japanese material that was made for export in the late 1940s and 1950s and 60s was inexpensive, cheap, and not not anywhere near the same quality as the material that was made before World War II.
Oh, okay.
I don't know
so
if that answers your question.
No, it does. It actually gives me a better idea of what to look for rather than novelty items, which, you know.
Well, there's some cute novelty items. I mean, some of the stuff that they made was whimsical and entertaining and fun, but a lot of it was just kind of, you know, five and dime type stuff that not much care was taken with.
All right, Meg, thanks for the call. And now let's go to another Meg in Schenectady. Hello, another Meg in Schenectady.
Hi. I have a Duncan Fife sofa, and it's the same one as I saw in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1960 and the Berkshire Museum in Pittsfield in about 1990. But I allowed it to be reupholstered at one point, and I didn't know enough to tell them that they had to give me back the brass pins. The brass studs. So it's reupholstered, but it is an original, and I'm wondering what the value would be.
Well, it's hard to say. Duncan Fife Furniture is one of the most popular styles of American furniture that was reproduced in great quantity from the time of the Philadelphia Centennial in 1776 through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So I'm not saying that yours isn't an original. It very well could be, but there's lots of ones that look like the originals that are out there. As regarding the brass tack, having it upholstered, I don't think the missing the brass tacks is not going to make a significant difference in its value. If by mm-hmm. some miracle it excuse me, dated to the circa 1810 and mm-hmm. had all the original upholstery and everything, you know, that would be a great rarity, and it would be worth having the original upholstery would give it a great premium in value. But it's unlikely that the upholstery that was on it when you had it reupholstered was the original. So I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it, but I would definitely have somebody that is familiar with period American furniture take a look, just so you can get an idea of whether it actually is an original one or not, because an original Duncan Fife sofa is going to be well into the five figures. You know, it's going to have very good value. It's iconic, the iconic American furniture maker.
All right, Meg, thanks for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Mark Lawson of Mark Lawson Antiques here, proving to be a very popular guest. Before we take our next break, I know that you do painting restoration, mm-hmm. which has got to be... Now, you don't do this personally, right?
No, we have a conservator that we work
with. That's got to be some very stressful work. I think I saw an item in the news not too long ago about a purported Da Vinci.
Oh, yeah.
And they sort of botched the restoration, or at least there is some question about it.
Yeah, it's very tricky. We get a lot of paintings restored for people, oil paintings on canvas, and the hardest part is when somebody comes in with something that they care a lot about, and for whatever, usually because it wasn't the right techniques weren't followed when the picture was created, it started to deteriorate and it's unrestorable. That's when it's hard. But most of the time, you know, it's repairing. Most of the time, it's cleaning, simple cleaning, which with oil paintings, the last step that happens is a layer of shellac or varnish is put on it that protects the painting. That way, the shellac or varnish gets dirty, not the original work of art. And cleaning is simply a process of dissolving that layer of shellac with the dirt that's collected on it and putting a new layer.
How do you do that?
Well, with old paintings, it's easy because they all used resin-based shellac from tree sap that dissolves with alcohol quite easily. Once you get into the early 20th century, there were all sorts of different funny varnishes that came out, so that can be tricky. You test. You test little square centimeter patches, see which solvent works, and then use that one.
But sometimes you screw it up, though. I mean, this is what I'm saying. It's like, it's got to be very strict. People who restore paintings must have a couple of cocktails at the end of the day.
The I it, in my experience, the good ones really know what they're doing, and the it's like being a fighter pilot or something.
Yeah.
Or an astronaut. I don't know.
Or a broadcaster. Not really. All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Mark Lawson. We talk Mark Lawson Antiques today, and all the lines are loaded. We'll try to get to as many calls as we can in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Boy, I'm glad we have no calls about comic books and sports cards, because tomorrow we're doing that. Our producer, Jim Lavoulis, is getting us in the real sort of roadshow mood here. So tomorrow is comics and cards. Today, antiques with Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques. And two fast emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. We'll never get to all of these. We'll have to have you come back. By the way, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, has a picture or something, and says, I have no idea what this is, do you have an email address where they could do that?
Yeah, marklawsonantiques@gmail.com. And all the information's also on our website at marklawson.com.
All right, cool. So marklawsonantiques@gmail. And then you also have the website, marklawsonantiques.com. Okay, very good. This one is an email from JVBP. I don't know what that means. Having sent a number of Morgan Silver dollars to the PCGS grading service to determine their MS grades, three of the what would otherwise be graded 60 to 63 came back designated as sliders. I don't know what that is. Is there a rule of thumb as to what one would expect to receive from a dealer for what PCGS claimed were cleaned? Well, now, what's a slider? I know, they're delicious.
A slider, it's not quite good enough to be called uncirculated.
Ah, okay. All right.
But in some cases, it might slide through.
So 60 to 63 is a good grade?
Yes. Okay. Well, it's the minimum uncirculated grade. Uncirculated starts at 60 and goes to 67.
All right, now I understand.
Or
okay.
Actually, it's a 70.
And so the question is there a rule of thumb as to what one could expect to receive from a dealer for what PCGS claimed were cleaned, which is a no-no?
Yeah, it's a no-no. It depends on how good it looks. It's all about eye appeal. Generally, with Morgan or Peace silver dollars, they're all worth a little bit more than the silver value. The silver value today is around $10 or so. And depending on their condition, they're going to have a market value. Any common ones are going to have a market value anywhere from $11 up to $30 or so for like an average low-grade uncirculated coin. Sliders probably is going to be, somewhere between $20 and $30 for a common date. Now, uncommon date, it's going to be worth more. There's going to be a premium on those.
All right. This one is from Helen. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This one's from Greg in Cooperstown. I have an Econolite Circus motion lamp from the 50s, unused and still in the box. I'm wondering what the value might be.
Cool. I'd have to look that up, but that the motion lamps are really fun. I don't know if you know what they are, but there's the two plastic sleeves with pictures on them, different pictures.
And they get hot and move?
The inner one gets hot from the lamp and turns around, and you get like the waterfall at Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
I've never seen a circus one, so that's uncommon. It's got to be worth at least $100 to $150.
Unused in a box, so
yeah,
that's nice.
And plus, so minimum $100 to $150, could be worth more. I think I haven't seen one of those before, so I think it's an uncommon one.
All right, you ready to see how many we can get through here?
Let's
in the
go.
Last 15 minutes or
All
so?
Right.
All right, we go now to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi. I had two Horace Jones looking glasses or mirrors, both of which were had the labels on the back, Horace Jones, Troy, New York, much better than the one that they had on display at the Albany Institute of History and Art. I had a house fire, and one is crisps, and the other one is 19 by 43, and it had the label on the back, which was lost in the fire, but it is signed in large ink, Horace Jones. It's 19 inches wide, 43 inches tall, federal style, glass over glass, small pane over larger pane. The front was blackened to the point where, and I was a professional at restoring things, so I very carefully restored the finish on it. But the glass, which is original, lost some of its silver on the back. There's a place in southern New York here that will re-silver it. I have two questions. One, is it worth doing that? And if I do, should I insure the glass so that it if it comes back broken? I'm not quite sure what to do to bring it up. And the other question is, I bought it from an antique dealer who was very from White Creek originally and now lives in Vermont. And the price that I sold it, the guy never picked it up. I've had it for 27 years since I sold it.
Okay.
And I'm just kind of curious what the value of that kind of mirror is now. It's because it is signed.
All right.
On the back.
Fair enough.
I think signed and with original in original finish and condition, it's going to be worth at least several thousand dollars. But again, I'm not looking at it, so it's really hard to say for sure. In terms of the restoration, I know Peebles Island Conservation Center in Green Island may be able to help you or may be able to refer you to somebody reliable. But I think as long as you package it well and insure it, adequately, the insurance, not so much to, it's probably irreplaceable, but at least when you insure it, you ensure that the Postal Service or UPS or FedEx will take special care with it. So that's probably your best bet.
All right, Mark, thank you for the call. Over to Paul in New Paltz. Paul, you're on.
Yes, I'm calling up because I have a sheep's wool blanket, which was made by my great-grandmother in Titonka, Iowa. She sheared the sheep, matted the wool, and made a sheep's wool blanket.
Nice.
And my question is, are there any other sheep's wool blankets out there? Now, the sheep have been living on this planet since 2000 B.C.
Okay.
And they have been sheared. And sheep's wool is used in many and various ways. But
sure.
What I want to know is anybody making sheep's wool blankets anywhere?
All right. This is a little out of Mark's league here, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think there still are places. And again, I'll say it again, Google's your friend. Traditional handmade sheep's wool blankets. I'm sure there's places where people, I know there's places where there's people that spin the wool and felt it and on looms weave them into blankets. So I'm sure it's not something that I know of anywhere personally, but I know the places out there if you look for it.
Well, thank you, Mark, for the call, or Paul for the call. And Mark Lawson is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551, although I got to be honest with you, the lines are full, and we'll just have to do this again. Lou in Altamont. Lou, you're on.
Yes, I have a picture, a photo. It's approximately 7 by 10. It's sort of sepia-colored. It's in poor condition. I will admit that. It is identified on the back by a series of handwriting that says it is the flagship Philadelphia at Honolulu. It's being decommissioned, apparently, in Honolulu in March 1894. My little bit of research on it indicates that this may have been the ship that accepted the transfer of Hawaii to America. Hmm. It's got a full listing of all its flag officers, and that's basically what the photo is. Except that in one corner you can actually see the enlisted men peeking over a deck railing.
Is it all signed by them and autographed, or is it printed?
It's hand-printed on the back, but I don't. The handwriting appears to be the same.
Sure. So somebody wrote down who it was. Sounds
and
like
there's a series of numbers on the front that you can reference the number to the person, and then go to the back and see the
all right
the name.
So it sounds like a nice piece of historical memorabilia with photographs of this period. It's probably an albumen photograph mounted on board. They can be reasonably collectible. This sounds like definitely like a collectible one, particularly if it has the historic connection with the transfer of Hawaii to the United States. It's something that a specialist really has to see. One good specialist for this type of photograph is Swan Galleries in New York. They're very good
I've heard of them.
With this sort of thing. But it sounds nice. It sounds interesting. Probably, you know, the condition is gonna determine what the value is ultimately.
Lou, thanks a lot. Now we go over to Mary in Grahamsville. Mary, you're on.
My grandmother had a wide Tiffany ring. It's 18 karat gold with platinum overlay. And
okay.
There had been apple blossoms in it, but now they have worn down because my mother used it for many, many years.
Sounds like a beautiful
anyway,
ring that she loved.
Worth anything?
Oh, certainly. Having the name Tiffany on it. Again, with this, like the last gentleman that called in, the condition is definitely going to be a factor in what the value is. Is it worn beyond the point of saleability? Rings with diamonds in them are worn to that point, the diamonds also have some damage. Diamonds are the hardest mineral known, but they're very brittle, so they can still break and chip and get, you know, abrasions on them. So that's something that and then the size and quality of the diamonds, which if it's Tiffany,
no, there's
should
no
be...
diamonds. It had apple blossoms engraved in the platinum.
Ah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Sorry, I misunderstood. It depends on how much is it completely worn away, so you really can't get a sense of the apple blossoms at all?
Right. You can't see them at all.
Mm. It's most probable
but
that it's just going to be...
It's still platinum on the outside.
Sure. And you're still going to have...
underneath.
So if it's platinum and 18 karat gold, depending on its weight, it might be worth, just for its metal value, anywhere from, you know, $150 to $300. It's hard to say more without seeing it and weighing it. But it's unlikely, being worn as it is, to have much more value than that, even though it has the Tiffany mark on it.
So you're certified in diamond grading.
Yeah, and took the course of the GIA.
I assume you see a lot of jewelry.
We do. Yeah, it's one of our areas of specialty. And as we were speaking before, it's something that I've had a passion for since I was a kid.
And why?
I don't know. Maybe it's my mother read me The Hobbit, you know.
You ever see any of those?
Smaug's
My
Treasure,
precious.
You
All
know.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. Mike in Albany. Mike, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question on concert, like, posters and programs and T-shirts. Is there any market in that at all?
Yes, I think they're collectible, but I think you have to go back to at least the 60s and 70s for them to have some significant value. Now, that is a little bit out of my area of expertise, but generally... older is better. I know I see lots of posters, concert posters, and the concert posters that have value are the psychedelic ones from the late 60s and early 70s. It's really a matter of, for this kind of collectible, what's going to have value is going to be the material that's rare. And once they started mass producing and mass marketing this stuff, then the general collectible value, I think, went down. So you have to get back before the marketing and mass production was such a big thing as it is today.
So my tattered old Cheap Trick t-shirt, probably not worth that much. All right, fair enough. I'll bring it in if you want.
Okay.
Debbie and Hurley. Debbie, you're on.
Hello. I'm calling regarding something that my mom had from her grandmother. My mom's now 81, so we're talking about something that's well over 100 years old. It's 25 to 30 different teacups, all different designs and styles, and they're all complete. Nothing's broken, even with the saucers. And I was wondering how much anything like that would be in today's world.
It kind of depends on the, it depends to some degree on who the makers are. But I'll tell you, generally across the board, nobody uses, very few people use this sort of thing anymore.
Exactly.
And they were very, very popular in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. I've seen, over the years, I've seen giant collections of these. And they, I think they're the common ones you can find in thrift shops for $2, $3, $4 a set. Fine ones by good makers. Now, an exception to that, there's a company called Coalport in England that made beautiful hand-painted cups and saucers in the late 19th and early 20th century that can be worth hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars. There's exceptions to that rule, but it really has to be something special to have some good value today.
Debbie, thanks for the call. Mark Lawson is our guest as we close up the program here. A few calls left, perhaps, if we have time. Now we go to Ray in Saugerties. Ray, you're on.
Yeah, hey, you guys are amazing. I love the history.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
You're like a walking history book. Anyway, this is a little bizarre. I go hiking, and I came across a dry creek bed. And I'm American Indian. I saw something out of place, and I found a dinosaur bone. And I tried to contact people to have somebody look at it, and I just didn't have any success.
Hmm.
What do you think about that question?
How do you know it's a dinosaur bone?
Oh, it's totally solid stone.
Cool.
Oh,
very
interesting.
Very strange.
Wow, that's cool.
And I go and hand it to people sometimes, and they almost get creeped out to even handle it.
That's great.
So... I think this is going to be a facet of an area of the lapidary or gemological world, you know, the world of fossils. So you need to find somebody that's a specialist in fossils. That's I would look on Google. That's the direction that you want to go in.
How big is the bone?
It's about 2 feet.
Wow.
Wow, that's pretty
cool.
And
it's solid stone, and it's really strange.
Wow, man.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. I guess you probably don't see many of those.
No, that's the first one I've heard of, actually.
That is great. Well, that was a good call to wrap up the program. Mark Lawson, how do people get in touch with you? Well, first of all, how do they find out about your business?
Our website, marklawson.com, is a great place to start if they want to contact us. Our email address is marklawsonantiques@gmail.com. Phone number is 587-8787.
That was pretty fun, huh?
Yeah, that was great.
You think you'll come back?
It. Oh, absolutely.
You know, my producer, Jim Lavoulis, sometimes he'll strike out. He'll give me a show that's impossible to do. This one was very easy to do.
Yeah.
So therefore, I'd like to have you come back. And the phone lines are still loaded. We apologize to Dolores, Mary, Pam, Donna, Ken, all of you folks on the line who didn't get through. We'll do it again next time. Good job today, sir.
Thank you so much, Ray.
Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, partnering in preserving historic New York through advocacy, education, grants, and loans. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. Mother Earth Storehouse, serving the Hudson Valley with a variety of seasonal items and organic and all-natural foods. MotherEarthStorehouse.com for daily events on cooking demonstrations. And Travels with Sarah, organizing private African safaris with authentic tented camps and lodges, accompanied by Africa specialist Sarah Kearns, 845-926-4774 for more information. Well, thanks again to Mark Lawson of Albany's Mark Lawson Antiques for joining us today. Thank you for listening and for all the great calls, including the ones who didn't get through. You'll get your chance next time. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. No antique, but he's valuable in his own right. Thanks to Susie Checkey for answering the phones. Our producer, again, who hit a home run with this one, Jim Lavoulis. Don't worry, he's only hitting about 350, but that's still a good average. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow we'll explore the world of comics and sports cards. Stand by now for news.